give the vote to the audience in front of the table.
May it please the court. I represent the petitioners in this case, David Reagan and his daughter, Julie Reagan. The question before this court today, at least one of the primary questions, to use the language out of Whittlesey, is does Julie Reagan, a minor, have a cause of action for mental anguish and loss of consortium as a result of severe physical injuries caused to her father by the negligence of a third party? Or I suppose to put it another way, will this court permit the recovery of Sanchez damages in a situation where you have a non-fatal, albeit a very severe, injury? We are specifically asking you not to carve children out of the cause of action that has already been permitted in the parent-child relationship with respect to Sanchez and a number of other decisions, and with respect to the familial relationship that has been articulated by this court. We've provided a chart here which does not in any way attempt to have all of the cases, but, and I've also given each of you a smaller version of it, to basically show the logic of what we are trying to present to the court today. We've basically broken this down into simply a 2x2 matrix of parent-child or spouse, husband-wife, injury and death. And as you can see, three of the four corners of that square, that 2x2 matrix, have already been filled in expressly. The fourth, the parent-child injury case, the case we have here today, we believe has been filled in, but not expressly so. This case comes to you with some history to it. The facts are not very complicated, and I don't intend, with the short amount of time I have, to spend much time on the facts. But there are some facts that are important. David Reagan was severely injured. He was hit by a baseball bat in the head and suffered a severe brain damage. His daughter, Julie Reagan, for all intents and purposes, lost her father at that point just as surely as if he had been killed. In fact, it may have been worse, because he now functions only on the level of a 6 or 7 year old child, and he has no capacity to lay down new memory. He is left with the memories that he had at the time of this injury, and cannot add to his memory bank, his brain, any more memories. And so not only has she lost the ability of a father to provide her with the nurture, care, compassion, love, affection, care, guidance, those things that create the parent-child relationship, but she has to confront that situation each time they are together again. And at least one court, the Hawaii court, pointed out that that may make this injury even worse than the type of injury where death is a result. Shortly after the Sanchez decision, which was based on Whittlesey being an injury case, Sanchez being a death case, the Austin Court of Appeals wrote the decision of Benight versus Western Auto Supply. And they really raised the issue that I think in another format that is before this court today. They talked about natural justice and said, on the basis of natural justice, it would be hard not to reach the conclusion that this cause of action would lie. And they go on to say that there is a clear, obvious injury in this situation. And they raise the question, may it logically be said that Joe Benight's relationship with Kathy Benight, being husband and wife, was harmed in this instance, but the child was not? They go on to say, is the child's interest less deserving of legal protection than that of the husband? Well, there's a significant history in that regard. If anything, I would suggest to you that the child's interest is elevated, that it is of more importance. This court, in about 10 years ago, talked about the parent-child relationship and the importance of the family, and quoted from the U.S. Supreme Court and acknowledged that the integrity of the family unit has found constitutional dimensions, has found protection within the 14th and 9th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution, and held in that case that the natural right between parents and their children is one of constitutional dimensions. And that has continued throughout the history of this state. As recently as 2 years ago, A court of appeals reiterated that. Some short time ago, this court decided the Jelani case, where children were permitted to sue their parents. But the importance of that decision, I think, for this purpose, is to talk about how this court has viewed the parent-child relationship. And I suppose I would like to suggest at least one passage from Justice Gonzalez's concurrence that says, "We trust that it is not out of date for the state and its courts to be concerned with the welfare of the family as the most vital unit in our society." The suggestion has been made in the defendant's brief that Whittlesey is really different because the husband-wife relationship is somehow unique. But to the contrary, this court has consistently talked about the unique relationship between parent and child, and then went on to say in Sanchez that it is analogous to the husband-wife relationship found in Whittlesey. Sanchez is a very important case because I believe that it defines the parameters of what we're talking about. It has already determined that there is an interest to be protected. The parent-child interest is there, and it is deserving of protection. In another case decided by this court, in the Hall versus Birchfield case, this issue, the fact pattern, was before this court, although this court did not directly write on it. But the Court of Appeals did, and the point of error on that precise point was brought forward to this court, so this court had the opportunity, if it had chosen to overrule the Court of Appeals, to do so, and chose not to. But the Court of Appeals there, the Texas County Court of Appeals, said, perhaps certainly better than I could have, "No reasonable distinction can be drawn between the loss of companionship in society with respect to a spouse as compared to that of a parent-child relationship." In fact, that court goes on to point out, and it says, "Society and companionship between parents and their children are closer to our present-day ideal of the family unit than the rights of the parents to the earning capacity during the minority, which once seemed so important when common law was originally established." And they talk about the shattering effect there. In addition to Hall versus Birchfield, this court has also had another case before it on these facts, where this court used the words impairment of the familial relationship in connection with the loss of that right on a daughter-father relationship, and that's the Salinas case. Salinas dealt with a situation where a mother was brutally raped in the presence of her daughters. As a result of those injuries, the father left. And part of the recovery that was sought at the trial court level and that was recovered was the loss of the relationship between those minor children and the father, one step removed from our situation. They also recovered for the loss of the relationship with the mother. And this court, in reviewing the evidence, said there is clear evidence to support the loss of this familial relationship and used that specifically with respect to the familial relationships in question in that case. The history then has been, in almost every instance where this question has come up in the state of Texas, the courts at the appellate level have said, "We recognize the obviousness of the injury." And as the court in this case said, they effectively invited this court to finally issue a clear mandate permitting that. They didn't disagree. They didn't argue that we were not entitled to it or that we shouldn't be entitled to it. They just said that they did not yet see as clear a mandate from this court as perhaps the trial judge did, and certainly as I believe is there. Other cases from other jurisdictions also provide ample support for this. The history has been that 1978, Whittlesey was decided by this court, and 1983, Sanchez. If you simply look at recent history, history over the 10-year period from 1980 through 1989, there have been 19 decisions on this issue. 11 of those have said, yes, we do find a right to recover for the child in an injury situation. In 8 decisions, they said no. One of those subsequently reversed itself. 1980, North Dakota said no. In 1988, they came back and reversed themselves and swung over to the point of saying, yes, injury in this situation is going to be permitted. If you look at more recent trends, the 1984 through 1989 period, you're talking about an even greater proportion. 8 of the 10 decisions during that period permitted recovery by the child. The most recent decisions, the Hawaii decision and the Arizona decision, not only permit recovery, but they go through and deal with each and every one of the arguments that has been proffered as reasons not to do it by the defendants in this case. One of the defendants offered by the defendant in this case is that, well, there might be some duplication of recovery. That same tired old argument was offered 12 years ago in Whittlesey and was rejected at that time. Arguments have been made that somehow this would cause some kind of conflict in the family if there is a limited amount of resources. But that's no different than in any other situation, such as the death situation. The question really boils down to whether you're going to say that a child is going to be precluded from recovery by the mere fortuity of whether the injury results in death or only severe injury. The final argument that has been made by the defendants, so far as we can tell, is that, well, perhaps this ought to be something that the legislature should look at. Again, the same argument that has been made in virtually every one of these other cases. In Sanchez, this court specifically dealt with that injury, with that argument, and said, no, particularly tort law is appropriate for us to make those kinds of decisions. This court has never said no. The court in Sanchez said, we're not going to look at legislative inaction to say we can't do it, and I would suggest we shouldn't look at this court's inaction up to this point for saying no. But again, going back briefly to the Sanchez decision, it sets out the different important factors that I think have to be considered. The court has always endeavored to interpret the laws of Texas to avoid inequity. What is more inequitable than to go back to Julie Reagan and say, well, Julie, if your dad had died, you could recover. But because he just can function at a 6 or 7 year old level, and because he is still alive in body, not really in mind, but in body, you can't recover. Or to say to the child of a father who is in a coma and can provide no communication, well, if he were to die, you can recover. But if not, you can't. That is the most inequitable of circumstances. This court utilized logic, compassion, and the needs of a modern society to make the determination in Sanchez, and I suggest that those very same criteria and concerns exist just as well today. The needs of a modern society says to abolish whatever antiquated rule there was that children couldn't recover for this kind of injury in favor of the recovery of loss of society and mental anguish. For those reasons, we would ask that the court reverse that part of the Court of Appeals decision that took away the mental anguish and loss of society damages recovered by Julie Reagan, and to affirm the trial court's decision in that regard.
What period of time are we talking about with the recovery, especially lifetime for the child, or until the child reaches the age of 18, or until the child reaches some less age? Or?
In almost all decisions, Justice Ray, the courts have said that it would be for a lifetime. There was an argument at one point by some of the commentators that only you could only do that until they reached majority, and the courts who have looked at that argument have said that doesn't make any sense because the relationship, the parent-child relationship, goes on. And I would suggest that this ought not to be treated any differently than the relationship of the husband-wife. The parent-child relationship, although it may go through some ups and downs at times, is a lifelong relationship and is no different really from that standpoint than the loss in the future of the parent, of the spousal loss of consortium.
What measurement thing would you use in terms of the number of years?
Well, I think the same way we do for other things on damages for mental anguish and things, and that is the life expectancies of the parties involved, and the jury would have that.
Whose life expectancy in this case?
I'm sorry?
Whose life expectancy in this case? The child?
I think you'd use the shorter of the two, which would ordinarily be the parent. That's what we used in this case. We took the life expectancy and said basically what she has lost is for the rest of her life when she would expect a father to be there, which in this case would have been about 50 years, she is losing that opportunity. Now, that is obviously much more poignant during certain periods of time. The time when it is most poignant would be the time closest to the event and during those childhood years when you need it. And I think that's the kind of thing that juries are uniquely suited for making the determination.
Thank you, counsel.
Any further questions?
Well, just one. Of the state that would recognize this cause of action, had it been uniform and the element of damages had been allowed?
They have been pretty much uniform in the elements of damage, that is, the loss of the parent-child relationship and generally on mental anguish. The one distinction that they have made is some of the courts have said we will only permit this if there is a severe, permanent, disabling injury. They haven't made it clear how they expect that to be handled by the trial courts, but they have said that in a couple of the cases that they would limit it to that. That's what both Arizona and, I believe, Hawaii did. Certainly we would fall into that category. I don't think there's much question about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here now, Ms. Bobby.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, Mr. John P. Vensky from Houston will present the argument for respondent.
May it please the Court, I represent the respondents and also the petitioner on the other writ of error, point of error that this Court has granted the writ on. What the petitioner in this case has requested this court to do is to join a minority, and it is a minority, distinct minority of jurisdictions in the United States, and recognize a new cause of action or element of damages, however we want to phrase it. This would be the recognition of a cause of action or element of damages that is not recognized by the Restatement of Torts. The Restatement of Torts recognizes the Sanchez-type damages, but rejects the very damages that the petitioner seeks to recover in this case. We have referred in our brief, and there's an amicus brief that was filed recently that may have picked up a case or so that I missed, to the cases in the other jurisdictions in the United States that have gone the other way, that is, accepted our position and denied recovery in this area. And it's important, I think, to note, and it was just pointed out to you that recently some jurisdictions have adopted this cause of action. I think that the alternate argument can be made. For example, the state of California has rejected this since the 70s and 80s, and it has stood the test of time in New York, in Florida, in California, in jurisdictions that I think this court typically looks to for guidance. And I particularly ask the court to look at the Borer opinion, which is cited in the brief, which is the California opinion, which discusses in great detail this area of the law. And it's important in Borer because not only is it a California case, but California allows recovery of Sanchez-type damages in death cases, but specifically looked at this situation and rejected these damages in non-death cases. We disagree that this court has previously held that these type damages are recoverable. It would seem to be the fact that we're here answers that question. The Sanchez and Kavanaugh cases are obviously based on the Wrongful Death Act, a legislative mandate. And I think it's important that this court look back where we've come from before it decides whether we're to go down another road. The purpose of Sanchez was obviously, as it was pointed out in the opinion, is that it was a minor child. And in those days, if the minor child was killed instantly and had no pain and suffering, so there was no survival action, there was no recovery by anyone. Because in the monetary recovery rule, it could be shown, frankly, that the parents saved money, hard-hearted as it is to say, by the child dying that young. And so it made common sense to say we're not going to let a tortfeasor escape from doing a wrong, and this is discussed in the Borer opinion also, by the death of a minor child. Kavanaugh was a somewhat logical advance because it was an adult child. But we'll see, and I think it is important, that opinion did deal with the husband and wife relationship, and it is a different relationship than a parent-child. We're not here to say that there is not a special relationship between parents and children. We're not here to say that it was not injured in this case. There's no question about that. I can't get up here and tell you that because I tried this case and I saw Mr. Reagan and I understand his injuries. But what we are saying is that not every injury can be recompensed. And as we point out in the brief, at some point a line must be drawn, and we say it should be drawn here, and I will point out to you in a minute why it should be drawn here before we open a true Pandora's box to other causes of action.
If you're saying that there is a special relationship between a parent and a child,
right.
Admit that.
Admit that.
But you're saying, nonetheless, not every injury should be compensable. I guess you're going to tell us why no injury to a special relationship should be compensated or recognized by this court.
Well, Justice Gonzalez, I can take that further. If this court were to make this whole, then I do not see any logical reason why a brother or sister would not have the same cause of action, why the grandparents would not have a cause of action, why a close friend would not have the cause of action. It's a line to be drawn, and I don't believe it's an arbitrary line, because I think the distinction is between the husband and wife relationship, which is the Whittlesey opinion, that special relationship. But if the court says, okay, we're going to let children have it, then I think it only logically says, well, the brothers and sisters can have the cause of action, the surviving grandparents, cousins, close friends. I don't know how far we go. And as I point out in the brief, what we're doing here, and I think it's significant that the petitioner requests the court to give not only loss of companionship or consortium damages, but also mental anguish damages, which are totally separate. Because if we do that, then this court's recent opinion in the city of Pasadena versus Freeman is basically overruled, I think. In that case, the court specifically said that there are limitations to allowing an individual to recover from mental anguish in the contemporaneous perception area. If this court rules in favor of the petitioner in this case, that's gone. That would allow, in that case, the stepfather in that case would have had a cause of action for a loss of companionship of his injured stepson. So I think it's important. That's one of the areas that I think it's important the court focus on before they decide to go down this road. But to specifically answer your question, yes, there is a relationship between the child and the parent, and it has been injured. But at some point, a line must be drawn, and our argument is it must be drawn here. Now, the Borer Court in California has pointed out some reasons for that kind of limitation, and I think it's a well-reasoned opinion. As I said, I think the court should really look at that. Borer talks about that there's a difference in a death cause of action and in a person and in an injury cause of action. In the injury cause of action, the living adult has a lawsuit themselves and makes a recovery themselves. There is the potential for the duplication of recovery. And all these factors I think the court must look at. I'm not saying one factor alone. The multiplicity of claims, which I'll talk about, is determinative. But it's a factor before you go down this road. And the Borer Court talks about that there is the potential for a duplication of recovery, because the damages recovered in an injury case by a plaintiff would be in some way those loss of taking care of his child. Also recognize that money would not go to the child until the child becomes an adult, and at least theoretically, the most of the care and guidance is already gone. I understand that as you grow older, you still turn, we hope, to our parents for care and guidance. But in this situation, the minor child would not physically get the money until they were an adult. And the Borer case points that out. Some of the other factors that the courts have looked at are the multiplicity of claims. Now, once again, I'm not going to tell the court, and I know this court has looked at this in other situations and said we're not going to worry about that, but we should look and be aware that if we say this, then the next case you're going to see is the brother-sister claim, the grandparent claim, the cousin claim, and we're going to throw Freeman right out the window, and we're going to have those carefully drawn limitations that this court struggled to find are going to be gone. I also want to mention, as I say, I do not believe this court has held these damages recoverable. The Salinas case, no question, that it does mention the recovery for familial damage, but I can't tell that was ever raised. The only issue that I can see was raised was the evidence to support it, but not the legal concept, so I don't think that's precedent for this.
We'd let the child recover if the child were a bystander, wouldn't we?
Yes, and they were a bystander. In that case, some of the elements, in the Salinas case was a terrible case where the woman was raped in the front of a cab, our children in the back, and the court, that could kind of explain it, but also there's the husband did leave after that. But yes, you would recover in a bystander situation. And that's a totally different area. And as I point out in the brief, that the mental anguish aspect of this case, it seems like what the petitioner wants is to grant more recovery, not only for mental anguish, not only for the loss of consortium or parental guidance, but also for mental anguish, which is not allowed in the husband-wife type situation. Let me point out one thing. Now, there's an argument that we waived that argument about the mental anguish, and I just point out to the court, cited in the brief, we objected to the issues. We raised it in the motion for judgment, opposition for judgment, and judgment NOV. We raised it in the motion for retrial and argued it in our brief. So I don't believe it's waived, and I wanted to point that out. But I think it's very important for the court to focus in on the fact that they are also asking the court to grant not only loss of consortium, but also mental anguish damage.
How was that issue worded in this case?
There were two issues. One was, and I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor, one was mental anguish, past and future, and one was loss of, and I don't believe I had that in front of me, Your Honor. It was loss of care guidance type issue. Commonly called a consortium. I mean, in some courts in other jurisdictions are called a consortium. Some have just called it a loss of care and guidance.
What social policy are we dealing with here? Just an extension of insurance coverage? Are we dealing with not letting every member of the family recover?
I think that there are also courts in other jurisdictions have talked about insurance coverage. And some courts have vehemently said that's not anything we're to be concerned about. Others have said it is something we're to be concerned about. The one court that, and I must admit, I can't remember which jurisdiction it was, says we got to look at this cause of action because this is a recovery for an individual who was not physically injured, and I understand that's no longer a requirement, but was not physically injured and is being allowed to recover intangible damages for someone else's physical injury. Now, we've crossed that bridge, and that's okay. But before we extend that kind of nebulous, more nebulous than a physical injury cause of action, we've got to look at all these factors. One of which is, does it raise insurance rates? One of which is, does it increase the multiplicity of claims? What about the statute of limitations?
We also look at what society would have to pay if there isn't any insurance to compensate this family?
Sure. And, Your Honor, I think that's correct, but I think they are compensated in the injured party's cause of action.
So you wouldn't personally object to this court were to adopt the policy that the legislature adopted some time ago, and that is any bill that they consider has to have a fiscal impact statement. If you adopt this bill, this is what it's going to cost you, and if you don't adopt it, this is what it's going to cost you.
Well, I think that it's a factor that other courts have looked at and that this court may well look at, and that is what is it going to do? And I think that is a legitimate factor to look at. I do.
So that would be another social policy that Justice Ray referred to that we should
possibly look I think so.
As to whether or not to extend this.
I think so.
I suppose that we should also look at the size of the family of the injured individual.
Well, I think there are all sorts of problems. That is one. And I think
so it might be to a defendant's interest to just inflict injury on an orphaned hermit, I suppose.
Well, if you're going to defend a case, I think that's probably true. I mean, that hard-hearted as it is, if you sit back and look and evaluate a case, no question about it.
I'm just saying, if we're really going to be serious about looking at fiscal impact, and to its ramifications, don't you think we have to logically?
I think you do, but as I said, I don't think that is the only factor that I think the court ought to rely on. I don't think there's any question that they it's a factor other courts have looked at. To get back to one of the other issues, questions that will arise, the statute of limitations problem, too. I would assume, although I've seen one court that says these cases should be joined as one, if it's a minor, you know, our statute of limitations says they have a disability and that the cause of action may not arise until the child is an adult. Another factor to look at before we extend that cause of action. The Arizona, and the other factor is we're not only talking, as the old saying is, hard cases make bad law. We're talking about a man here who was, no question about it, and the evidence was clear, was very seriously injured. Do we then say that in every personal injury case, a man who injures his back on the job or an automobile accident, do they also have the cause of action, or do we go to this, it seems to me, untenable plan that Arizona has to require it to be a serious type of injury? So that what we're doing is not only talking about the cases where there's a true coma or brain damage, are we talking about every single physical injury would open the door to all the other claims. Another issue I think the court would have to look at. Also, we brought up in the brief, and the Court of Appeals seemed to put the cart before the horse. The evidence in this particular case, to get back to this particular case, is, and we brought up a no evidence point before the Court of Appeals, which held, interestingly, there's no cause of action, but if there was, there'd be evidence to uphold one, is we brought that point before this court, and we request the court, if it were to find such a cause of action, to look at the evidence in this case, which I think shows no evidence to allow such a recovery in this case. We simply request this court, this is a policy question, there's no question about it. Courts have gone both ways. We can look for guidance to those courts, and I think it gives us some very good guidance. But what is very important is that we look where we're going in the future. There is logic to drawing this line because of the difference in the family relationship between the husband and wife and the child and the adult.
Since this is a policy consideration, do you think that policy should best be made by this court on a case-by-case basis, or should it be done by the legislature?
Well, I think I don't have any objection to this court making these kind of decisions, as frankly, as opposed to our legislature, which I don't know what they would do. But the problem is what the legal system needs guidance from the court. And a decision like this truly is a significant decision to open more areas than for Mr. Reagan and his daughter. This is a truly significant decision for all those other potential claimants out there, and non-severely injured potential claimants also. I want to cover briefly the point that the court granted the writ of error on the special issues in my case, and I want to very briefly touch on that, the distinction being the negligence issues were as to the three individuals, Mr. Reagan, Mr. Vaughn, and Mr. Nichols. And then the comparative issue read Nichols individually in DBA, Kajak's Lounge, name of the bar, and the same for Rosenbach. And we brought up the point of error that that was not sufficient to support the court's judgment. The one point I really want to cover on that is the Court of Appeals said that under Clifton, this court's opinion, Clifton, the defendant in a personal injury case has the duty to submit the comparative issue correctly. And I think that's an overbroad statement because that would, I think the Clifton case says that the defendant has the duty to get the plaintiff's negligence submitted and found and get the plaintiff's comparative issue found. I don't believe the defendant in a personal injury case. If I try a case and the plaintiff doesn't submit my comparative negligence, I'm not going to squawk, I tell you that. So I think it's an overreading. And I think I want, as the court granted the writ of error in that, on our point in the special issues, I do not believe the issues, as they stood, never complained about after the trial by the plaintiff in a motion for judgment NOV or to disregard the issues, which we did bring up at that point, are sufficient to support the judgment in this case, and we'd request a reversal on that grounds.
That is an increasing problem for the court and the counsel. I think the Rules Committee is wrestling with that problem too.
There are no other questions.
Thank you, counsel. Butler?
May it please the court. Basically, the argument that I heard here today primarily concerns where do we draw the line?
Does it have to be drawn?
I don't think that a line has to be drawn. I think a line has been drawn, however, and this court has already said that the parent-child relationship is a familial relationship deserving of protection. That line has already been drawn.
Has the other part of the argument been who ought to draw the line?
I think that has been a part of the argument, and I think that, again, this court has traditionally been the one to draw lines in tort areas, and has done so.
You would join your adversary in suggesting that this court is better able to draw these lines in the legislative branch.
Well, yes, sir. I think that the whole idea of common law has been that is court-created and brought along and is created as the times change to some extent, and the court gets to do it on a case-by-case basis and looking at policy considerations. I don't think that it is extremely reasonable to suggest that somehow by permitting Julie Reagan to recover the same kind of recovery she would have if her father had died as opposed to simply been severely injured raises the Pandora's box argument that the defendants would suggest. There is a difference between brothers and sisters and grandparents that have been recognized in other cases, and this court has said, no, you're not going to permit recoveries under some of those instances. But that doesn't have to be reached in this case, and that is not what this case suggests. What this case suggests is that this court should not permit an inequity to exist. And the inequity is that if Julie Reagan cannot recover unless her father dies, she can recover if he dies, but not if he lives in these circumstances. That is an inequity.
So then do you agree that this rule of recovery that you're advocating here should not be extended to sibling recovery?
I don't think that it's necessary, and I I would prefer not to make that argument until that case comes before the court, because I think that the courts can make bad law trying to predict all of the ramifications that aren't before it. I think that's the reason courts generally don't give advisory opinions, and that would be at best an advisory opinion in this case.
So you don't think Pandora's box is open?
I don't think Pandora's box is open.
But it's not locked either.
Oh, I think that I have a good deal of faith in this court not opening Pandora's box, and it hasn't done so yet, and I don't think it's going to.
What about the problem of defining injury, serious injury? There is no definition of serious injury, and if there is, there's problems, and if we do recognize the cause of action for loss of consortium for children, injuries to parents, that any injury, there will be another cause of action.
Well, this court has already faced that in the husband-wife relationship and didn't limit the spousal recovery to only severe injuries to the other spouse. I suppose the question is, why should they do it with respect to children? I don't think there's any reason to do it. If the court does so, I agree, that is another thing that would have to be done. I don't think it ought to preclude recovery in this case, or should preclude the court permitting recovery in this type of case.
How about the limitations question raised and the problem because children, limitations are not run until at least 8 to 18.
Well, I mean, that's a problem that exists with children, and I don't think what this court does in this instance is going to have that effect, is going to stop that problem at all. That is simply a problem that children have causes of action that don't run until they reach majority. And what the court does here doesn't really have any effect on that. For example, let's look at the Benight case. In the Benight case, the wife had given up her cause of action and signed a release. And then the husband came along and was permitted to recover for the injury, but the child was not. Now, in that case, there was already a splitting of the cause of action. Let me get to one thing real quickly, since I know I'm running out of time. This is not a bystander case. And I want to take just a moment to get that out of here. It's not a bystander case. Freeman was brought solely as a bystander case because Freeman was a step-parent. He couldn't bring the Wrongful Death Act. And he didn't bring one. He didn't bring this cause of action. It was purely and simply a bystander case and has nothing to do with this case. The bystander rule was an exception created by the courts to get around the general rule that mental anguish would not be permitted unless there was proof of physical manifestation. And the bystander rule was a rule used as one of those exceptions. This court in Sanchez says another one is in the injury to the familial relationships. The reason being that mental anguish is something that the courts have always been a little skeptical of and wanted to be assured of the genuineness of the injury. With the injury to the parent-child or the husband-wife relationship, that genuineness, as in the death cases, has been established and no requirement is needed for the proof of physical manifestation because the court is convinced already of the genuineness of the injury. Now, on policy matters, I want to only deal with one other thing, the fear of excessive verdicts. That's sort of one of the things that came up. If you put all this together, that's a lot of what Mr. Binsky said. This court specifically wrote on that in Sanchez and said, the fear of excessive verdicts is not a sufficient justification for denying recovery for loss of companionship. The judicial system, this court among you, has adequate safeguards to prevent recovery of damages based on sympathy or prejudice rather than fair and just compensation for the plaintiff's injuries. And then also points out it would be unrealistic to separate injury to the familial relationship from emotional injury. And I want to point out that in Sanchez, this court didn't talk about death result in something. It said we are permitting recovery for injury to the familial relationship. The familial relationship being that parent-child relationship. It's injury to that relationship that this court used. Those were the words used by this court. In terms of the line being drawn, I think that the line has been drawn appropriately. The line has been drawn around the nuclear family, parent-child, husband-wife. That is a reasonable line. It does not require extension. What the defendants are really asking is that you carve that out in the injury case and have, instead of a nice, easily understood, logical square, something with a hole in it. And perhaps that's our difference, because I looked at the defendant's brief and I saw the quote from Paul's graph that says, this is not logic. This is a matter of practical politics. Just got to draw the line somewhere. I don't think this court reacted that way. In Sanchez, this court said it is logical to draw the line here. It is not a matter of politics. This is not a plaintiff defendant, a Republican, Democrat, a conservative, liberal issue. Everyone on this court at one time or another has effectively written about the importance of the family unit. And this is an instance when we can all come together and say, that family unit, we've already decided that line should be drawn there, and we're going to protect those interests, and we're going to compensate for injuries to those relationships. And I think the line has been appropriately drawn, and would ask that it be drawn on that basis.
Mr. Higgins, regarding the special issues, did you request mental anguish damages in addition to a loss of companionship?
Yes, sir. There was a separate blank for mental anguish and a separate blank for loss of the parent-child relationship. And again, simply going back to Sanchez, what the court held here is that it would be inappropriate to separate emotional injury from the loss of that relationship. I mean, the fact of the matter is, in this instance, I think it is reasonable for those to be two separate things. She has lost something. She has lost the ability of that father to help her as she's getting ready to go out on dates, and then when she gets ready to get married, and all of those things we can think of. But she also has to deal with this father who now can only communicate with her on a 6 or 7 year old level for the rest of her life. In fact, is going to ultimately become a burden on her as his parents and his brothers and sisters can no longer care for him. So she has the mental anguish of facing that situation, and that's what the Hawaii court pointed out. The loss in this kind of situation is more severe than the loss in the death case, because each time they're together, they re-confront that injury.
In this case, you know, the parents have been divorced a couple of years before the injury, and she was living with her mother.
That's correct. Now, of importance during that time, for example, even after they were divorced, when the mother had something to do, David Reagan would go over and babysit with his daughter. I mean, it was continuing to be a close relationship, but it continued to be an amicable relationship, albeit they are divorced.
Thank you, counsel. That completes the oral submissions for the morning. The preceding cases are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That completes the business of the court.